Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson. I'm one of the hosts on the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Chika Watanabe about her book, Becoming One, Religion, Development, and Environmentalism in a Japanese NGO in Myanmar, which is out in 2019 from the University of Hawaii Press. Becoming One is a rich ethnographic study of the work of a Japanese NGO called OISCA, the Organization for Industrial, Spiritual, and Cultural Advancement. Watanabe takes a deep dive into the daily workings of OISCA and explores the moral imagination of constructing unity based on a distinctly Japanese-marked set of ideals and practices within the confines of an unusual Japanese NGO working for decades in Myanmar. OISCA is intriguing in its own right, with roots in a post-war new religion and connections both to right-wing politics in Japan and commitments to a kind of new Shinto-derived global environmentalist and also to a Japanist-slash-culturalist social reform agenda. Becoming One is especially significant as an object of study given not just the NGO's unusual pedigree, but also the historical relationship between modern Japan and Burma-slash-Myanmar and the ways in which OISCA forces us to re-examine the politics of international aid and development. Watanabe's book is attuned to the muddy, dorokusai processes of making people, hitozukuri, and constructing a shared sense of home, furusato, that animate the everyday workings of OISCA, as well as the tensions that these goals create on the grounds in the training camps. So, Dr. Watanabe, thank you so much for joining us today. So I wonder if you could tell us about how you came to this project that eventually became the book Becoming One.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me on, first of all. So I'd always been interested in NGO work, questions about humanitarianism, development aid. That was on the one hand. And on the other hand, I wanted to do a project in Myanmar, Burma. And so I looked around, different avenues for pursuing that. I started out being interested in assistance to refugees in the Thai-Burma border. But for various reasons, I gave that up. And then when I realized I could go to Myanmar and Burma, and this is in 2006 or so, 2006 when I started my PhD. I just met about, different people. I went and I really, one of the things that my supervisor at Cornell told me was, I know that you're interested in NGOs in general and humanitarianism, but I suggest you look at you consider looking at Japanese organizations, primarily for practical reasons, because there's a lot of funding for research related to Japan, but not so much about Burma, Southeast Asia at the time. So I went, I talked to, Burmese organizations, but also Japanese NGOs. And so partly it was, for practical reasons that I ended up, looking at OISCA, because it was the one organization that was quite open about having a researcher come in, whereas other Japanese organizations tended to be a little more cautious, especially given the political climate. But on the other hand, I was also interested in general, how organizations marry their missions or ideals of how to make a better world with practical, with their practical projects. And OISCA is one of those organizations that has a pretty clear vision of of how it wants to change the world, in contrast to a lot of other Japanese organizations whose mission statements, interestingly, are quite practical. If you go online and look up Japanese NGO mission statements, they're often, you know, our mission is to build bridges or our mission is to build schools, right? So part of it was, you know, I was interested. I found the mission statement that Oiska put forth really, really interesting in that, you know, sort of the ideals that they were trying to reach for. And at the time, I didn't realize that it was the way it was because it was coming out of a religious organization or religious vision of the world. You know, so the project started with my general interest in humanitarian issues to begin with, and Burma, Myanmar, but then the way that it unfolded around questions of religion, non-religious arguments, environmentalism, agriculture, all of those things were just products of the choices I made and not necessarily what I started out with.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about what it was specifically about Burma/Myanmar that had sparked your original interest?
Yeah, let me think back. well, again, so much of it is about coincidence or contingent links that you end up making, because as I mentioned, you know, first I was interested in, I've always been interested in questions of refugees, refugeeness, migration. And so at first I was interested in the Thai-Burma border, you know, as one of those case studies that I wanted to learn more about because I wanted to learn more about refugee issues in Asia. And I just happened to meet someone who ran a nonprofit organization in the border region. He was Japanese. So I ended up spending some time in the refugee camps. So that's how I got, you know, I first, you know, thought about Burma and Myanmar, because until that point, it wasn't, you know, particularly, you know, the country that I was specifically interested in. It was more the refugee issues that drew me to the country. But then once I started looking into it, I noticed that, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, not a lot. There's, you know, some asylum seekers in Japan. And at the time, you know, this is in the 2000s, and it might be the case today as well, but I don't know the figures. But one of the groups that get recognized as refugees the most are from Burma in Japan. Even though they're not, the highest number of asylum seekers are not from Burma, but they are the people who get recognized as refugees the most in Japan, or they were at the time. And so I found that really interesting in terms of if I wanted to do a project about Burmese refugees in Japan, you know, that could be perhaps a topic that I could pursue. And I did think about that in the first year of my PhD when I realized doing the Thai-Burma border thing was, you know, in terms of the language practicalities, you know, I would have to learn Burmese and Thai, and I realized that was probably going to take me a little too long. So then for a time period, I was thinking of doing a project about Burmese refugees in Japan. But so I've always, you know, I was always looking into projects that would link me to Japan in some way or another. And it just happened that, you know, yeah, Burma came along at that point.
Yeah, so then you went back and did your field work in Myanmar. And that sort of brings us into the book, sort of setting the scene for, you know, what you're writing about in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about when you did your field work, what the situation was in Myanmar at the time, and also a little bit about the historical relationship between Myanmar and Japan and sort of why that was important to your work in a more general sense, and also Oiska, which you mentioned, which is the NGO that you worked with.
Yeah, so I first went, now I can't remember, I think it was 2007, perhaps. I can't remember, but it was around, you know, 2007, 2008, there were these protests that had happened, monks marching, and then there was Nargis, the cyclone. I can't really remember when it, but it was around that time that I went, a couple of times over the summer period. I first went in relation to helping, Japanese organizations, but also Burmese, NGOs at the time. When I, I mean, you know, Japan, I think I, you know, as you know, probably Japan has been one of the biggest, largest donors to Myanmar throughout its you know, its military regime, the history of that time period. Japan continued to be a big financial, you know, donor in a, you know, sometimes in an indirect way, but still it was one of its, I mean, allies might be putting it too strongly, but, you know, it was one of those countries that engaged, you know, productively engaged with the military regime, I suppose. And so, and often the discourse around it, at least, you know, maybe not so much from the Burmese side, but definitely from the Japanese side, has always been, oh, you know, Burma, you know, Myanmar and Japan have a special relationship. You know, this idea of having a special relationship. And some of it was harking back to the Second World War, forgetting the colonial period. It was always about, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi's father, trained in Japan in order to, you know, defeat the British and, you know, and fight for the Burmese, rights. And so, you know, and also just Japanese commentators would often talk about cultural similarities between the Japanese and the Burmese. And, you know, as you know, there's people who are called in Japan, birukichi, like people who are birumakichigai, like people who are crazy about Myanmar. So there's something, you know, there are political reasons for that relationship, but there was something affective or sentimental about that, that connection the Japanese people often invoked. And so I wanted to understand more how that impacts, or if it has any impact on Japanese development aid in the country. So, and this is not really something, you know, a few people obviously have written about it, but it's not something that had been explored in depth, and definitely not ethnographically. So, you know, I wanted to do that a little bit more, and also to, you know, on a, you know, not related to Myanmar specifically, but to offer an ethnographic inside view of what it means to do development aid in a non-Christian, you know, non-Euro-American organization, which, you know, we don't have very much of in anthropology.
Yeah, so you're working with this sort of very complex and fraught then, you know, post-colonial relationship between Japan and Burma. And I thought it was particularly interesting that this, you know, sort of ostensibly Shinto-based NGO, OISCA, was the organization that you chose to do your fieldwork and book about. Can you then tell us a little bit about OISCA and about its goals, philosophies, the history of the organization to the extent that that's relevant?
Yeah, the history of OISCA is really interesting because it's one of the oldest NGOs in Japan. So most of the narrative about Japanese nonprofits and NGO start, you know, around the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis in the 1970s. But then it picks up, you know, mostly people focus on the rise of nonprofits after the Kobe earthquake in 1995. That's when the legal system, you know, for NPOs and nonprofits to register came into effect. And so, you know, people tend to refer to that period as the history of NGOs in Japan, but you know, OISCA started in 1961 officially, but had been around as an entity, you know, from the 1950s. And, you know, there were only two, three other organizations at the time that did sort of international development type work. So in that sense, you know, OISCA, I think, offers a really interesting insight into the history of NGOs in Japan and development aid in general, because, you know, 1960s is also when JICA, the Japan International Cooperation Agency, which is the Japanese version of USAID, you know, that in 1960s, it was, you know, it was when it was founded. So Japan's governmental aid structures and systems were still in its infancy at the time. And so OISCA in many ways, you know, led the way for what Japanese international aid would look like. So, you know, tracing its history, I think, ended up being really interesting. And the fact that it came out of a Shinto, you know, inspired religious movement was also unexpected for me because that's not what I went looking for. But it turned out to be really, it gave me insights into Japanese history, Japanese politics that I had no idea about. And it might be that I'm just ignorant about Japanese modern history, But it really caught me by surprise because the founder of Oiska was the founder of Ananaikyo, which is this Shinto inspired religious movement that comes out of a bigger Shinto inspired group called Omotokyo. And interestingly, it was through his role, through this founder's role as a religious leader, that he came into contact with powerful political figures, you know, in the 1950s onwards. So politicians, as I mentioned in the book, the president of Nichidai, of one of the universities in Japan, you know, they all linked up with the founder of Oiska because of his role as a religious leader, because they believed that his role as the leader of a religious organization could lead to votes or, consolidate certain political interests around, you know, nationalist sort of interests. And so Ananaikyo, the founder, you know, they all had, as I explained in the book, conservative leanings and, you know, right-wing connections in terms of political ideologies, about, you know, the emperor, about, revising the way that World War II, the Japan's role in the Second World War was thought. You know, they wanted to put forth ideas that, you know, that Japan was trying to liberate Asia and did a lot of good around the region and so on. And so a lot of the older staff members at Oiska come from the religious organization. And so they also had those, you know, sorts of messages they wanted to put forth. And I found that really surprising, and I did not expect it at all. But it's been interesting, you know, because I never knew that people who were behind creating Japan's development aid structure system, you know, had such strong ties with, you know, basically the Liberal Democratic Party and, you know, other conservative, even more conservative figures behind that historical formation. So I found that really interesting.
So that ties in nicely to the next thing I was going to ask you about, which is about Oiska's then aid philosophy, right? So your the title of your book is Becoming One, and you suggest that that's part of a sort of moral imaginary of becoming one that's couched in terms of very specifically Japanese values of the, you know, in scare quotes, of the type that are colored by the sort of religious and politically conservative nature of Oiska. So can you tell us about how Oiska aid works in practice, sort of, you know, what is their philosophy? What is it that they're trying to do? And in particular, you use this word doroksai in Japanese to describe it. I wonder if you could unpack that for our listeners.
Yeah. So the idea of becoming one was in some ways it's obvious when you interact with people in Oiska, because they see that a lot, you know. And when I first came across it was, so Oiska runs these training centers where people from, so they have training centers in Japan and they have training centers around the Asia Pacific region. And in the training centers in Japan, which is when I first, you know, where I first went, they have trainees come from all over the world, mostly from, you know, Asia, but also from other parts, like Central America. And they live together for a year. And it's a very communal, collectivist sort of lifestyle where, you know, everybody sleeps in, you know, gender segregated dorm rooms. There's Japanese style baths, so which means that everybody women and men separated, but, you know, bathe together. Everybody wakes up at 5 in the morning, and, you know, we clean, and there are these morning routines which I describe in the book as well. You know, I begin the book with these morning routines because it seemed to me militaristic, because on the one hand you have things like the jiotaiso, which is the I assume the audience is not necessarily going to be Japanese scholars. So, you know, these exercises that people do in schools or sometimes, in companies, And you know, it's to this music, to this particular music, and you do these prescribed sort of movements. So that's not militaristic necessarily, but it's accompanied by salutes and military forms of marching, and you raise the Japanese national flag, and so on. You know, so when I first saw that, I was taken aback because it's not what I expected to see in an NGO. I've worked in Japanese NGOs and, you know, that were founded much later, more recent ones. And they don't look like that at all. Right. So, and because I'm Japanese, at the time I was in my 20s, a relatively young Japanese, person. And so people in Oiska, when, you know, they would anticipate that I would be horrified or think that it's anachronistic. And so they would tell me, oh, you must think that this is so weird and you must think that this is so, you know, anachronistic. But it's really important because it's a way to bring people together and to become one, right? Like, 一つになる or, you know, 一体となる. And so they kept explaining these disciplinary, collectivist sort of lifestyle as, you know, important for people from different cultures and upbringing to come together and become one, and explain that as being important for, you know, if they go on, what idea was that they would go back to their communities and become community leaders to lead, you know, some kind, you know, a form of sustainable development initiative of some kind. And in order to do that, they would have to learn how to become one with people in their communities. And so their explanation of it was, you know, if you are marching down, you know, towards the flagpoles, you know, you have to be aware of the person on your right and on your left and make sure that you are matching their movement. And that sort of consideration of other people's movement to become one with others in the physical movement, you know, was important for, you know, spiritually becoming one with others and therefore be able to become good leaders in a community. Which was really, you know, interesting because it seems egalitarian, you know, all one, you know, but obviously it was very hierarchical as well. So in practice, it was, you know, part of it was these collectivist lifestyles. On the other hand, it was also these ideas of, becoming one with nature, paying attention to the rhythms of the seasons and, you know, the texture and condition of the soil. And, you know, a lot of that, I think, is common to any agricultural organic agricultural endeavor. But they would, you know, talk about that in terms of the founders' ideas of being in tune with the natural world and therefore using organic methods. And this idea of doroksai, again, you know, this was when I first went to, or maybe it was the second time that I went to Myanmar, and I met the staff member who was in the Yangon office. And she just gave me an overview of what Oiska does. And she, you know, she explained to me, oh, you know, Oiska is an organization that's a bit doroksai. You know, and I noted it down, but I didn't really think about it. And then later on, I realized, you know, like that's a really great metaphor for, yeah, what Oiska does and what its ethos is, because, you know, on the one, it's about, yes, it, you know, do, you know, I'm making a pun out of it as well, but, you know, because doro, right, it means mud. So in some sense, you know, in some ways it is this idea of, you know, getting muddy in the fields, becoming one with nature. But also the phrase means, you know, sort of, you know, not, you know, simple in a positive way, you know, not sophisticated, not, you know, not urban. So, you know, something, there's a sort of, dignified or virtuous simplicity implied in doroksai, that I think, you know, Oiska staff members really wanted to put forth. And I think this collective living, disciplined lifestyle was harking back to these, you know, Japanese ideas of what it means to live this virtuous, you know, simplified lifestyle.
Yeah, that reminded me of the way that sometimes in, say, the business papers and stuff, you'll see Japanese pundits talking about Japanese capitalism versus Western capitalism as wet versus dry, right? That somehow Western capitalism is very dry. It's rational. It's quantified. It's inhuman in a sense. But that, you know, because we Japanese have a different way of being in the world and interacting with people, our capitalism is more wet, right? And it seems to me that there's a really sort of interesting parallel in the way that you're describing this, you know, ideological sort of rhetorical move to being doroksai, to being sort of, you know, down in the mud in that sense of, you know, kind of a wet, messy, but also very personal, right, way of doing things. And that also, it seems to me, connects nicely to another one of these keywords that you talk about for oiska, which is, you know, hitozukuri, right? So I guess you would translate that as what, people making, or is there a better translation for that? Could you tell us sort of how hitozukuri works for oiska, and what's the process and the sort of goal or end point, and how it's related to the religious character of oiska, if that's relevant?
Yeah. So, you know, hitozukuri is something that other aid entities use in Japan as well. And, you know, specifically JICA uses it, the government aid agency, because for a long time they said that that's what they do. They, you know, hitozukuri, or, you know, I translated it as making persons. And, you know, it's basically human resource development, you know, through trainings or knowledge transfer, skills transfer, in the JICA sense. For oiska, you know, I should have, maybe I do it. I can't remember, but, I should have a sense of when oiska started to use the word hitozukuri, specifically. But I wonder if partly it was a way to, you know, link up to the language that JICA was using. But, you know, it's also a language that religious groups use, in terms of, you know, reforming the world through the cultivation of people in a particular spiritual way. So it has this wide capacity to include all sorts of different interests. For oiska, I think the hitozukuri encompassed the kind of the way that they wanted to realize their vision. So, you know, as I mentioned, these disciplinary practices and collectivist lifestyle that they instilled on trainees, you know, for throughout the year, it was a way to create, you know, in some ways, you know, the hope to create new kinds of people who would not be individualistic, who would not be driven by self-interest, and who would always be attentive to the collective, to the interests and needs of others, and in particular, to, you know, to that of the well-being of the collective. And so I think that, you know, in the end, those are the kinds of people that they wanted to nurture, people who would, you know, participate in collective cleaning duties and, you know, be aware of, even if you finish your own work, you go on and help others in order to make sure that the whole unit, the whole organization is, you know, is going forward, or, you know, getting the work done. And again, you know, that's often described as a very Japanese thing, right? As if it's a very Japanese value. Part of it is a religious, you know, has a religious inflection, because there are a lot of other new religious organizations in Japan that emphasize this, you know, we need to change the world from the individual outwards. By changing the one person, we can change the world sort of belief system. But, you know, this created a sort of dilemma for people, because, you know, first of all, how do you measure that you have changed the person? I mean, maybe as educators, you know, we face the same dilemma. But, you know, like JICA, for example, funded some of their activities, and or other organizations, you know, other donors were behind some of these training programs. And of course, they wanted reports. They want to see, you know, the outputs, right? How do we know that we've changed the person, which is not really measurable? And a lot of them a lot of the trainees would, you know, spend a year in Japan or in a training center in Asia, go back to their communities. But many of them didn't really go on. I mean, most of them didn't, you know, haven't really gone on to become leaders of community development in the way that oiska envisions, because it's difficult, right? It's hard for it, because these trainees are usually in their late teens or early 20s. And so, you know, when they go back to their communities, they're young, even though they've spent a year maybe in Japan, you know, they don't have that kind of authority in their communities that would allow them to become leaders. They don't have the resources necessarily. So, you know, some of them would introduce organic methods in their community, in their villages, and that would be revolutionary in itself. But that also took a lot of convincing. And, you know, it was never, so one of the things that OISCA staff members, you know, would say to me, but also I found in the archives that they've been saying this from the 1970s, that they need to follow up better with trainees once they leave. Because they know that this 1 year is not going to really change a person. And so, you know, they need other kinds of support and follow-up systems so that they can actually implement what they learn and continue to be the kinds of people that OISCA wants them to be, you know, once they return to their countries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The sort of question of the follow up and how the trainees would sort of bring these, you know, whether essentially this experience at OISCA is the kind of, I don't know whether you'd call it a kind of cultural capital or not, or some intellectual capital that could actually be, you know, sort of actuated in the, on the ground. And that presents a sort of really, you know, fascinating question, for thinking about, I think, aid more generally. And I thought it was one of the really, you know, interesting pieces of the book in the way that, you know, this case study illuminates a very big, you know, problem about, the gap between intention and result. So we've been covering a lot of the material that's in chapters 1 and 2 specifically in the book, sort of implicitly at least. So I'd like to actually jump into chapter 3 if that's okay, because chapter 3 you begin with talking about the Furusato movement. And if you could explain what that is, when did it start, and sort of how it's relevant to thinking about the history and the works of OISCA in Myanmar.
Yeah, so one of the, you know, sub-mission statements, shall we say, that OISCA has had probably from the 2000s, or I should have reviewed the dates. But around then has been this idea of furusato zukuri or furusato movement. And the word, you know, furusato in Japanese means, you know, hometown or home village. It has more of a rural imaginary. And, you know, when people talk of furusato, it's, you know, sort of these rice paddies and, you know, this village nestled in mountains. And, you know, it has a nostalgic connotation to it. You know, and the reason why I focused, you know, one chapter on it is because when I was doing my field work, one of the key, tasks that the headquarters, that the Tokyo office had to figure out was, what is this furusato movement that they're trying to create? And so I remember being in meetings where they, you know, the staff members would say, okay, people from above. So, you know, the leader or, you know, the president and the board of directors and stuff, you know, they've come up with this idea of Furusato movement as one of the goals of OISCA. But what does that actually mean in terms of what we do? And so, you know, they had to figure out what the people above them meant by the term Furusato movement. But that was actually really, you know, those were really interesting conversations because we sat around and people talked about, okay, so what is Furusato for people? And how would that translate to our project? And so, you know, Furusato, you know, we just threw out ideas about, you know, so staff members would throw out ideas about, you know, what does Furusato mean? What does Furusato mean to you? And these were, you know, the staff members, this was in the overseas project, and they were in charge of the projects that they had around the Asia Pacific region. And they were mostly in their 20s, early 30s. You know, and they would say like, oh, Furusato is, you know, it had an affective connotation, right, for them, as well as an actual image of a landscape. And so I found that really interesting that they, you know, that they were talking about these ideas of Furusato that comes out, you know, it's very, you know, it has very Japanese connotations of what that means, Furusato. And they were trying to translate that into practical projects in the training centers around the world. And, you know, to make it relevant in non-Japanese settings. But interestingly, a lot of the non-Japanese trainees and staff the Burmese staff members in Myanmar, you know, they also picked up, they would sometimes use the word, you know, Furusato to talk about the training centers. And, you know, yes, they would talk about their countries as Furusato as well, but they would often mention the training center itself as being like Furusato for them because, you know, for example, in the training center in Myanmar, you know, some of the staff members had been there for, you know, 15 years or 10 years at least or most, you know, or more, and they'd been there since they were 18 or 19. And some of them had married other staff members or married once they became staff, married a trainee. A couple of them had children in the training center. And so a lot of them would say, you know, yeah, this is like my Furusato, right? It's home. They would, you know, say it's my home for me because, you know, I grew up with these people. I'm raising my family here. So I found that really interesting that on the one hand, it had so many different, you know, levels or scales. Because, you know, on the one hand, it was about Furusato imageries of, you know, rice paddies and villages in Japan, but it was also referring to the training centers, and that, you know, some of the writings by the president, you know, talk about Mother Earth itself being Furusato for all, you know, all living beings. You know, it's a home, that, you know, that we should take care of, you know, that kind of language as well. So I think, you know, OISCA was trying to use the word Furusato. It seemed in a kind of effective way, in that it links, you know, a very particularly Japanese image with, you know, trying to refer to Mother Earth itself as being Furusato for all life forms. And it's also about being, you know, about a training center, but also about the country. And yeah, I mean, it was a very multifaceted, they were able to mobilize it in a way that was very multifaceted. And I found that, yeah, I found that, yeah, really interesting to think about how people try to make sense of the word.
Yeah, and it strikes me that Furusato, along with some of the other Japanese sort of terminology we've been talking about, hitozukuri and orokusai, they're just specific enough to be sort of recognizably Japanese, and yet vague and kind of polysemic and, you know, enough that they can, that you actually have to sit down and have these staff meetings to figure out what Furusato means, but also that, you know, it can be Mother Earth itself. It can also be Myanmar. It could be, you know, it could be the training center. And it strikes me that the, you know, these sort of protean malleable words at the center probably, you know, are really important to the story of how you know, there's a gap isn't a charitable way to put it, but a gap between sort of the intention on the Japanese side and sort of how it's interpreted, adapted, actualized, you know, by people in Myanmar, by the Chinese, et cetera. That's one of the reasons that I wanted to, you know, sort of specifically focus in on that Furusato aspect of chapter three. In chapter four, you know, I guess you're sort of going back to this keyword of dorokusai. You're talking about what you say the ethics of muddy labor, the virtue of immersing oneself in the literal muddiness of physical labor and the metaphorical messiness of intimate relationships. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're calling the ethics of muddy labor? And we've sort of begun to touch on this at the beginning, but what you see as the relationship between mud and the intimacy and the sort of ethics that are part of the OISCA mission.
I think one of the things that I took away from OISCA is the ways that a lot of the staff members, especially the young people, the young staff who were not necessarily from Ananaikyo or were not religious at all, didn't necessarily, you know, from get-go believe in reviewing or, you know, having this revisionist view of the Second World War and all of that, you know, how they would, you know, I mean, and some of them did leave, you know, because they were really uncomfortable with the approaches that OISCA was taking, the disciplinary lifestyle and all of that. But also, you know, the ones I met that had stayed had, you know, really grappled with why OISCA as an organization might be emphasizing on these things that seem out of step with current times, and, you know, what it might, how they're making sense of it themselves. And, you know, I think I mentioned this in the introduction, but I found that sort of struggle really inspiring, I guess, in some ways, you know, because they weren't just saying, you know, just saying, I don't believe this, I'm going to leave it, but, you know, trying to, you know, really, you know, make sense of, you know, really make sense of, you know, the rattle that they felt with what they believed in and the values that they held. And, you know, and I think that's what I would call ethical labor. It's that sort of, you know, and a lot of, you know, anthropologists and others have written about this. But, you know, there's it's both an everyday moral struggle, but it's also, you know, these little moments of crisis, sort of, you know, moral crisis that happens throughout the day or throughout your life. And you try to work it out, like, where do you stand, you know, vis-a-vis these various, you know, struggles and conflicts that you come across. And, you know, I find that to be an effort, you know, the ethics of, you know, basically everyday living. And, you know, I saw that in OISCA, maybe in a more, you know, highlighted way, in a more, what's the word, you know, extreme, perhaps, situation, because some of the things made people, you know, really uncomfortable. But, you know, but I found that, you know, something to take, you know, really, you know, people seem to be, you know, both Burmese staff and Japanese staff seem to be trying to derive meaning from those kinds of struggles, you know, to make sense of why they were doing what they were doing, why the organization was asking them to do things in a particular way. And I found that struggle, you know, to be, if it was meaningful for them, I wanted to understand, you know, why and how it became meaningful for them. And, you know, so part of it was, you know, the muddiness of the labor, and especially in Myanmar, because the place, the landscape that they were in, you know, it's in a region called the dry zone. So it's a very dry area and it gets very hot in the hot seasons. And so the land was not really conducive to agriculture. And so, you know, I mean, muddy makes it seem like it was wet, but the soil was actually quite dry and hard. But, you know, so they had to struggle with that and, you know, make sense of why are we doing this here where the soil is so bad for rice cultivation? You know, in the end, by the time, you know, when I was there, it was thriving as an agricultural center. So they had succeeded. But, you know, so there was that aspect of it. But also because you live intensely with other people for 12 months or, you know, longer for the staff members, you know, you, it gets, there's a lot of relational conflict and friction. And, you know, there were fights, as I, you know, describe in the book. And, you know, I've described in a recent article that just came out, there were also romantic relationships, that broke down or made people uncomfortable. And so there was a lot of that kind of, you know, muddiness of relationships, you know, when you spend, you know, intimate time, with others for 12 months or more. So there was that sort of working out of relationships and, you know, what, yeah, I mean, you know, where do you situate yourself vis-a-vis those kinds of, you know, thick, sorry, only the Japanese word is coming to my mind, thick sort of relationships, yeah, in these sort of enclosed spaces.
Yeah, so that's, you have both the collective muddiness and individual muddiness, as well as the actual sort of physical question of, you know, sort of the mud of the environment, of nature, so to speak. In chapter five, you were just talking about relationships, you know, in relation to chapter four. In chapter five, you talk about how the family metaphor that Oiska sort of deploys promotes intimacy and solidarity on the one hand, but also fundamental power imbalances and relational hierarchies on the other. This was, I think, particularly interesting to me as, you know, a historian of modern Japan, because it harkens back to, you know, all these sort of questions about the historical relationship between Burma/Myanmar and modern Japan. How does this play out on the ground for Oiska's aid efforts in Myanmar?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And of course, you know, when I've given papers about this project, a lot of people ask me about, so how did the Burmese people react, or, you know, to Japanese people being there, having been colonial powers, and, you know, the history of Japanese colonialism. And, you know, this might be because I'm Japanese, but people, you know, didn't really mention colonialism to me when I was in Myanmar. You know, they didn't, it wasn't really, a thing that they mentioned. You know, it came up when, because, you know, in the parts that they are, sometimes they would discover things from the Second World War that belonged to Japanese soldiers. You know, but that was never really, I mean, that didn't happen when I was there. You know, I've heard stories of this and how, you know, Oiska staff members helped bring those objects back to Japan and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I didn't really, people didn't really mention Japanese colonialism to me. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that people don't talk about it, but for, you know, for both the Japanese and the Burmese staff members, the family metaphor as being both about solidarity and hierarchy seemed to, you know, sort of seem common sense almost. They really, you know, both the Burmese and the Japanese staff members talked about being in the training center, being in Oiska as, yeah, being like family. And of course they interpreted it, you know, in their own ways, as I, you know, described in the book. But at the end of the day, it was a metaphor that allowed people to accept that we could all be in this together, right? Being one, but also having unequal relationships, right? Like, you know, in a quote unquote traditional Japanese sense, right? The father has authority. That's so normal. But we're all part of, you know, the family, part of the community. And, I found that really interesting. I mean, in some ways, it's something that Oiska staff members, not consciously, but, you know, as an organization, I think has done really well is invoke these concepts or ways of framing things that make potentially difficult things common sense. Like, they make them atarimae. Like, they make them, like, obviously we're going to accept this. So, you know, like being like family is one way to do that, I think. Or, you know, this is like furusato, right? It's like, yeah, of course there's nothing, you know, of course we want to be in a place that feels like our home you know, that we've always cherished, you know, for a long time. Or, you know, West Side Describe in a, you know, in different, not in the book so much, but in a chapter in an edited volume, you know, I talk about how, you know, but this is not about Shinto. You know, the organization is not about Ananaikyo. It's not about religion. You know, it's about Shinto, but Shinto is not about religion. It's about Japanese culture. You know, how we value the sun, for example, or, you know, there are, you know, nature has life forms that we need to respect. And that's Shinto, you know, and Japanese cultural values. And it's, you know, atarimae, like even people who are not religious would accept that. So, you know, I think the family metaphor is one of those things that Oisuka does really well in advancing, you know, the kinds of visions that they want to instill in the world. And of course, you know, it has these, as you mentioned, resonances with, you know, with Japanese modern history, Second World War, or, you know, earlier, that can be a bit disconcerting as well.
Yeah, I thought this aspect of sort of, as you said, sort of naturalizing the hierarchical, what are often very hierarchical relationships, whether that's through family, whether in other ways, is something that kept, you know, it kept coming back to me as I was reading the book, that the whole idea of becoming one, you know, because of course, look, I'm, you know, I'm American. It says right on our currency, e pluribus unum, out of the many one, right? But that's also potentially a rather terrifying sort of national motto, depending on how you look at it and how it's actually practiced, you know, on the ground. But it seemed to me that, you know, the becoming one that you're describing here is full of these tensions where it's becoming one, but in many ways becoming a Japanese one, right? And that the naturalization of that through the metaphor of family, through these ideas about, you know, the muddiness, which again connects you to a sort of naturalized kind of set of relationships, right? That this was part of that, you know, Japanese Burmese hierarchy that seems to, you know, animate a great deal of what interests you in thinking about Oisuka. And one of the other places that I saw that is in your final chapter, in which you're talking about how discipline in the training centers connects to these very specifically Japanese imaginaries. And you pay a lot of attention to, as you put it, discipline as a particular modality on the one hand, and then, of course, the physicality of labor in the environment. How does this chapter sort of fit into the rest of the book? And more importantly, for me, it was, you know, why did you put this one last? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, I'd like to ask you, you know, after I guess, answer this question, you know, if you think that it could have gone somewhere else in the book. But for me, it felt slightly different because the other chapters were all in some way or another about grappling with this, you know, ideology of Japanese-ness in some way and how to universalize that while being particular. And I just couldn't get away from that. Whatever I wrote, it ended up being about that question. But for some reason, writing about the microbes, in the last chapter, you know, these, you know, the bokashi fertilizer and the EM, you know, microorganisms, for some reason, writing about that made me be able to write about questions of discipline and collectivity that were not just about questions of Japanese-ness. And of course, it had something to do with that because, you know, there were, you know, religious reasons and all that about, you know, lineage, you know, these sort of relationships through which EM became a thing. You know, these effective microorganisms in agriculture are a thing in new religious movements in Japan. So, you know, it is about that a little bit, but it allowed me to write about the relationship that people in these training centers were trying to establish with their environment, with the soil, you know, through these microorganisms that were, you know, also about becoming one in some ways, right? Having these relationships with these microorganisms. But it wasn't just, you know, I could write about that without it being about Japanese-ness per se. And that's why I put it last, because I felt that it was pointing to, you know, some of the potential ways that we can think about sustainability or, you know, sustainable environments from OISCA that, yeah, it doesn't have to be about nationalist ideologies. But I mean, I'm interested to hear from you, you know, if you think that it could have come earlier or somewhere else.
Oh, no, I had no intention of suggesting that. And by the way, I'm the one who gets to ask the question. So, no, but it just, you know, it occurred to me that that this was sort of, even though it carries on a lot of the themes that you are working with throughout, that it does sort of represent this, you know, significant departure where you're really thinking about visions of sustainable development in a way that is both linked to some of these issues of, you know, Japanese-ness and discipline and the sort of life of the training centers, but also this much, you know, sort of larger, you know, global environmental problem of sustainability and development, which I think, you know, it makes perfect sense to me to have that last, in the sense that it's a way in which to very specifically situate your case study of OISCA within, you know, a much larger context as a sort of part of a global environmental history and a history of, you know, global agriculture and sustainability. So we've come to the end of the book, but I know you also have other things in the works, and you've talked a little bit about some of the research and publishing you've done since the book. What's going on now? What's coming down the pipe?
So I'm working on, so my new project has been about, still about trainings in some way, but I've been interested in trainings that, I started out interested in trainings that JICA conducts around disaster preparedness, around BOSAI. So, you know, Japan, you know, boasts as being very good at, you know, being prepared for natural, you know, quote unquote natural disasters. And so one of the, you know, the JICA training center in Kobe, in the Kansai area, is focused, you know, around a lot of their trainings are around disaster preparedness, and not necessarily about technological or infrastructural methods, but, you know, what are called soft, you know, approaches. Through community-based disaster risk reduction or through schools and so on. So, you know, so I was interested in understanding better, again, you know, how do you cultivate people who are prepared for disasters that are often unpredictable and catastrophic, right? Some of them, you know, might be unimaginable, you know, which became a very big word. And so, yes, and especially to people from other countries that, you know, have different environmental risks, they have different political systems, they have different, you know, approaches to the future potentially. So, yeah, so it's sort of a continuation of my interest in making persons, and trainings, and also, you know, about how do you, yeah, prepare people towards, to expect the unexpected, you know, how do you prepare people like that in an international, you know, transnational context. So I've been looking at these trainings in Japan, but and how people from a particular town in Chile, in South America, called Talcahuano, how people from the disaster risk reduction department in this city who have all trained in Japan, how are they translating what they learn in Kobe and taking it back to Talcahuano and adapting it to their context? So again, it's a transnational project. So I've been going to Japan and Chile, which has been, you know, sort of logistically hard. I didn't really think about how far these countries are, but it's been really, really fascinating to see what kinds of things, you know, people pick, you know, in Chile pick up from Japan and take back. And the kinds of, yeah, I mean, I'm still working on my different analyses, but, you know, the importance of, you know, incomplete translations, you know, the productivity of that, and, you know, questions of ethics are still things that I'm really interested in.
Well, that does sound like you're certainly going to be racking up a lot of frequent flyer miles. But sitting here in Nagoya, where we're expecting the it's no longer the unexpected. We're expecting certain disaster. Certainly during my lifetime,
yeah.
I will be very keen to read your next book when it comes out, and I hope we'll be able to have you back on the channel when that happens. Yeah. So thank you for spending an hour with us, Dr. Watanabe. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Great. Thank you so much.